Hello, Growcast listeners. Jordan River here. Got so much exciting news for you today. First of all, now is your last chance. The prices for GrowPass are going up, everybody. Go to mygrowpass.com. I'm pretty sure that these prices are going up tomorrow morning. So if you're hearing this, now is your last chance to get in on it. What else do we got for you? Ooh, 20% off the Growcast merch store. That's right. Spreadshirt is doing a promo for today, September 4th, and tomorrow, September 5th. 20% off all Growcast merch. Just go to growcastpodcast.com, click merch, and when you're checking out, use the promo code anything20. That's anything20 for 20% off. Go get yourself a Growcast mug or a hat or a shirt. Very generous of Spreadshirt to be doing that promo. Today we have Matthew Gates. Oh, yeah, IPM specialist. I love this guy. I heard him on the Growing with My Fellow Growers show, and he is super, super knowledgeable. So you're going to love today's episode. Some in-depth IPM talk coming your way, and then some. What do we have? Shout out to today's sponsor, Mass Medical Strains, offering unique strains for every personality, every taste, and every mood. Stay tuned. You'll hear more about Mass Medical Strains. Just go to massmedicalstrains.com to see the selections. Oh, so much great stuff going on. Thank you all for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you. Best of luck in your grow on hump day and beyond. Love you guys. Without further ado, thank you all for listening. Please enjoy the show. Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to Growcast. I'm your host, Jordan River, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. Before we get started, let me ask you to please share the show with a friend. I always appreciate you guys sharing the show. And make sure you're subscribed, rate and review this show, as well as the Homegrown Helpers, Rob Smith's show. Always appreciate that, guys. Oh my gosh, I'm excited for today's guest. Talking about IPM and all sorts of different growing strategies. Really excited to dive in with Matthew Gates. How you doing, man?
I'm doing excellently.
Yeah, man, I was really, really excited to get you on because we just collaborated recently on the Growing with Our Fellow Growers show. And when I was on there, you and Dr. Coco were going back and forth, and I was just like, damn, these are a couple of wizards. So I'm stoked that you took the time to come on your show, come on my show. So thank you.
I'm always happy to help.
Yeah, it seems that way, man. You have a whole YouTube page. Why don't you talk about what you're doing on YouTube and where people can find you?
Sure, absolutely. So people can find me. Zenthanol is my YouTube channel, my educational channel, where I talk about science communication, things related to integrated pest management, plant physiology, and things like that. So people who are in the cultivation space, it could be cannabis, but it could be all kinds of other sorts of agricultural pursuits. I try to put that kind of information out there for people. I'm also on Instagram as Sync Angel, SYNCHANGEL. And it's sort of the same kind of content, educational, science communication, sorts of things like that.
Let's talk about how you got started cultivating. And I also want to talk about what kind of style of cultivation that you settled on, and also what you're trying to do with Zenthanol. Sorry for the long-winded three-part question, but welcome to Growcast. It's kind of my style.
Oh, no problem. You'll find that I'm also really loquacious, so it's not something I'm
loquacious. I'm loving the loquaciousness.
The loquacity?
Loquacity. Loquacity.
So I'm not actually much of a cultivator myself. I do cultivate personally on and off, but I like to work with people who are cultivating professionally. I work as an IPM specialist. So what that means is that I do site evaluations for people, or at least that's the major thing that I do. I also do identification of pests when possible, either remotely or on site. And I also work on IPM strategy with people who either have a strategy already or lack one. And I like to work with people who are very much in the sort of the new phase of agricultural pursuits with using integrated pest management, multifaceted approaches, an emphasis on biological controls and things like that, and less emphasis on treatments that can be easily outmoded, like chemical agents. You can still get botanical chemicals and other sort of chemistries that can be very good and useful, but if you overuse them, then they can represent a problem. They're also usually very broad spectrum, so that can represent a danger to the environment. And I've really enjoyed working with people in the past, like almost a decade now, moving from a more traditional aspect to a newer one that is much more environmentally friendly.
Mm-hmm. I know you're really passionate about not only IPM, but all sorts of different, organic practices and practices that focus on sustainability. And I want to get into all that for sure. Why don't we start with IPM? I know you're passionate about it. What can you tell my listeners about it in general? And what are some first steps for pest control that you like taking before reaching for the sprays?
Absolutely. So what integrated pest management means is it's just a strategy where in which you use many different techniques kind of all at the same time, or at least you have them all at your disposal to deal with pests. So like insects, but also like fungi and bacteria. And I often kind of look at it from the perspective of the kind of treatment, what category it falls into. So you have like biological controls, which are obviously living organisms. You have chemical controls, which are different chemistries, like I just outlined. But you've also got things like environmental controls, like if you can turn the heat up or if you can modulate the humidity in your environmental space. Now, not everyone can do it, which is why context is incredibly important. Mm. And that's why IPM is important too, because different strategies are going to be more or less viable for different people. And that's why I make such a big effort to go out and meet people and do more than just simply make the educational content. Sometimes it's just very important to find the unique set of techniques throughout the year and throughout the years at a certain particular location, because everything from your geography to your soil microbiology to the substrate you use to your SOPs and biosecurity, all of those holistically factor into your IPM strategy.
Mm. What are your favorite controls as far as, well, why don't you just tell me, why don't you go down the list? I know that predatory insects are a big thing. Are you into those?
Absolutely. I kind of cut my teeth, I would say, with IPM in my interest with predatory organisms and parasites and things like that can be utilized against pests. And it's really only possible in the last like few decades to really understand those what are called tritrophic relationships. So like the plants, the pests, and then the thing that kills the pests, or things rather.
Right. Not something we were always considering in the past.
Yeah. And not something that we were always able to like study very well. So like technology has also played a big role in our ability to kind of like from a holistic standpoint, and you'll hear me use that word a lot probably, but it's true. Like, you know, aspects outside of agriculture and IPM influence agriculture and IPM, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's obviously the case, but sometimes people don't consider how much external influences are on something that they kind of put in a silo. And so as technology has increased and our ability to understand the natural world around us has increased, and some really novel, like lateral thinking among people that wouldn't normally be intuitively what you would think has led to some cool technological advancements. One of my favorite ones is the use of micro aerial vehicles to apply predatory mites and other biologicals.
What, like drones or something?
Like drones, like just airdropping them, like it's Normandy, but it's in your strawberry crop or your hemp crop.
Wow. And that's just a really good dispersion technique?
Yeah. And, you know, it's really good for a lot of reasons. It cuts down on the backbreaking labor that farmers have to do. It also severely truncates the amount of time you have to. So not only is the labor less arduous, but the time you spend doing it is mm-hmm. way smaller, which means savings for everyone. And I'm a big supporter of that sort of mechanization to help people out, and also just costs less for everything. And it allows the biocontrols to be applied where they need to be, but also applied sort of broad spectrum.
That's really cool. Where do predatory insects specifically excel? You know, where do they fall short? And how can my audience of home growers kind of implement them in their grows?
Good question. I would say that they have fallen short more often in larger field environments. So a good situation for your home growers is that biological controls tend to work a lot better when you have more sort of area control. So an indoor environment or a greenhouse environment, for at least for biocontrols that don't fly, of which there are some that do, or at least at certain stages they do, they can be much more effective in the indoor environment because you can obviously control their ability to come away and go into the natural environment.
Right. What are your go-to predatory bugs of choice?
Really just depends on the context. But if I had to pick one that I just like in general, I think my favorite's probably either Buveria bassiana, which is an entomopathogenic fungus. So it's a fungus that infects many different organisms, which is what I like about it. It's very broad spectrum, and it's very effective in that broad spectrum capacity. I also like Amblyosis swirskii, which is a type 3B predatory mite, and that's a little bit of jargon, and I can go into that if you'd like, but
Please.
basically, oh sure. So basically, there are different types of predatory mites, from type 1 to type 4. Now, this is based off of an entomologist and acarologist named McMurtry, and he was able to classify them in ascending order from type 1, which are specialists against like what are called tetranychids or spider mites. And then type 4 are sort of, so as you go from type 1 to type 4, they become a little bit more omnivorous. They become a little bit more,
A wider diet.
exactly. And so from type 1 to type 3, you kind of have that spread from specialization to generalization.
Universal use. Okay, I'm following you.
Yeah, and so I like Amblyosis swirskii at type 3B because it feeds on pollen, which means that you can have banker crop plants, which I'm working with the Cannabis Horticultural Association to research the use of banker pepper plants based on academic research, where in greenhouse trials, researchers were using these pepper plants. What they found was that if you planted the pepper plants, they would be able to host these predatory mites because they feed on pollen and they actually reproduce faster on pollen. See, the females don't have to they don't have to hunt very much when they feed on the pollen. Now, it doesn't mean they don't go after pests, but it means that they can kind of just get a lot of the nutrition that they need to be very fecund and produce a bunch of eggs. And then when the pollen's gone, or when they've decided they have enough pollen, they can go out and look for prey. So that's very advantageous. So I like that aspect, and I like how our, like I said before, our understanding of ecology allows us to find novel techniques that are kind of low tech when you think about it. It's just a natural, like biocontrol sachet. If people are familiar with the use of predatory mites in those sachets that some organizations have, you just have one that you planted instead of one that you bought.
That's so cool, man. I'm really into that. What do you think of enzyme products? These products like the amazing Dr. Zymes or whatever that are harnessing enzymes for pest control.
I actually think it's a really cool concept. I think that it's another example of our study of the ecological world and how enzymatic processes interact with pests and also with plants, and how those interactions can, like you said, how they can be harnessed for use in an application for treatment. For example, like chitinase. I made a video recently about how researchers were able to see how chitinase, which is an enzyme that dissolves chitin, which is the primary structure of
Like crustaceans, right?
crustaceans, but also just arthropods in general.
Oh,
So
okay.
most things with exoskeletons have a chitinous
Right.
exoskeleton. And so the chitinase just dissolves that chitin, and it's just like
Whoa.
there's no ifs, ands, or buts. It's like pouring I mean, it's not exactly like this, but it's like pouring acid on your skin. Like, there's no resistance to that. Something very fundamental has to change about your physiology for that to be not a problem. And so absolutely using things like chitinase and chitinolytic lytic enzymes to have the same effect is, and then other things too, like there's many other sorts of compounds and enzymes that can be utilized to have this effect. But it's a lot to remember, and even I forget about little detailed nuances here and there because there's just so much to consider, because we're literally talking about the entire, like, holobiome, the entire, like, ecology of ecologies.
Trillions and trillions and trillions of different, right?
Things going on, yeah, like, and, like, you know, some plants, they just happen to have a really novel, like just to give an example, like azadirachtin from neem trees. Uh-huh. Like, you know, what produces neem? Well, neem trees do. And, like, is that found in other plants? To my knowledge, no. And so, like, sometimes it's just a really novel thing that's only found in one plant, but it happens to affect a wide variety of organisms on a fundamental level, which is why you have to be responsible with them and not overapply them or irresponsibly apply them otherwise. But that's another thing that I'm really proud about, is that I'm working a lot of times with cultivators who are cognizant and worried about that kind of a thing, and they really care about the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that farmers in the past never did, but we're just aware of things that are harmful in the right context that we weren't in the past.
Yeah. And my understanding is a lot of these alternative products, like the aforementioned enzyme products, they don't have the same runoff issues and, you know, systemic, you know, showing up in the concentrate testing and stuff like that, right?
Exactly. So you also, right. So, I mean, I don't want to justify or, like, seem like I'm defending anything, but I do want to say that, like, our chemical understanding, our understanding of chemistry, like, you know, half a century ago and nowadays is way different. And so back in the day, our ability to understand and utilize chemistries is much different. I guess I just repeated myself, but my point is that people were using systemic chemistries and thought, oh, it's fine, it's cool, it's going into the plant, that's perfect, that's what we need, that's what we want. It's like,
but you're saying they were a victim of their time.
That'll show them, sort of. Yeah, I mean, like, do I think that there were some unscrupulous behaviors about health and that sort of thing? I mean, I don't know any of these companies personally, so I couldn't tell you, but would I be surprised? No,
they're trying to sell their product. That's their job, to pitch it. You'd hope that the forces to counterbalance that sort of thing would have acted faster. It seems that it was a real problem. The more I look into the health effects of, you know, the pesticides that are now being outlawed worldwide that we have used on Big Ag, you take a look at something like Indosulfan or something like that. It does seem to be a real issue. And it seems these products are a solution to that issue, more or less.
I feel that way. Yeah. So, like, and, you know, there's so much that we don't know about how those chemistries interact with endophytes, organisms living inside your plants, which may confer benefits that we were unaware of. You know, just because you can't culture it in a lab doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And, you know, a large swath of microbes are just literally inculturable. Like, we just don't have the techniques or the media to culture them, so we don't really know what they're doing. And, you know, it's kind of fascinating. So, like, and that's actually, you know, getting back to your point about enzymatic products and other sort of newer biorational products, I feel like there are ways that even those can be harmful, or at least less advantageous than people want, because people are looking in this more holistic way, like chitin. Chitin is also important in fungal cell walls. So if you have a soil microbiology that relies on fungi, beneficial fungi, well, the chitinase or the citric acid, which is chitinolytic too, for those who don't know.
Whoa.
So yeah, that's why it's conserved in citrus and other plants, because it has that effect. And some insects have no problem with it, or they have ways to mitigate it because they've adapted to it. or they already happen to have the physiological requirements to. But you know, like if you spray even like a botanically derived compound like that, you might negatively affect your soil microbiota in a way that you thought, well, it's they're good guys. I'm the good guy. I got the spray. I'm using the spray on the bad guys. The good guys are going to be unaffected. No, that's not how it works. There's no good guys, bad guys dichotomy.
That's interesting, man. Yeah, so you really got to be cognizant of that sort of thing. But yeah, I'm excited to see how this sort of thing develops. What excites you right now in the cannabis growing world? What are you interesting yourself in, and what topics and subjects are you kind of diving into?
I like that we are looking into the cannabis genome. I like that we're looking into the virome and the microbiome of cannabis particularly. I made a video that I was very passionate about the subject of, which is cannabis cryptic virus, not because I think it'll be a big problem. In fact, preliminary research suggests that it's a cryptic virus that maybe doesn't do anything, but it is passed through seed. It can go vertically from parent to offspring. And I just think it's fascinating how organisms, just like how that kind of occurs. And looking how, and other sort of endophytic organisms. I'm on a big endophyte sort of binge here. Like
kick. You're on a kick right now.
Yeah, I'm on a kick. I'm on a kick of these sort of microbes that live like on the in the phylosphere, in the rhizosphere, on the phyloplane, on the surface, or inside the plant, and how they modulate and affect us in the same way that people are perhaps interested in the gut microbiome.
Sure.
And how that has fundamental effects for humans and other organisms with gut.
You're talking to one, my friend. I just spoke with Dr. Marvin Singh on the Coffee Health and Science podcast and did a whole episode about the microbiome that just about blew my mind. I want you to finish whatever point you were about to make. It sounded poignant, but I also want you to come back to the cannabis cryptic virus because I'd like you to elaborate on that. I haven't heard anything about that.
Absolutely. So I guess to make my point, I find that sort of thing fascinating. And in the same way that like, and it's helpful for IPM as well, because if you know what's in your plants, and I promise you, if anyone who knows me and has talked with me, they know that I can be a little bit long-winded and, like I said, loquacious, but I also kind of laterally jump. So let me go back to cannabis cryptic virus, and then I'll talk about the microbiome and why it's interesting. So the cannabis cryptic virus is interesting to me because all cryptic pathogens are. And so like Botrytis, for example, can be cryptic. And so learning new things about how pathogens get into plants and how other microorganisms get into plants and also animals, and then how they can be symbiotic or parasitic or commensalic or mutualistic or all of those sorts of things. Mm. Because plants have an innate immune system. But they don't have an adaptive immune system like humans do, which I like to sometimes simplify as calling it immune system 2.0. And so plants have this innate immune response, which is also still very complex. It is not an insult to call it 1.0, but they don't have like white blood cells that they produce that like, right. You know, they don't have like an analog that kind of like goes out and hunts like a hunter killer mm-hmm. cell, but they do have something else. They basically just hire on mercenaries, which are the free living microbes and also organisms that have a more symbiotic or obligate symbiosis.
Whoa.
And some of them even have them with many of them have them with like pests and also beneficial organisms. So like understanding that relationship can beget strategies that might be really fine-tune and scalpel-like so that you don't have to endanger a whole bunch of organisms. You can just kind of target and eliminate the pests that are affecting your crop. Because, of course, we shouldn't forget that these organisms exist in the natural world and are a part of the ecology. So eliminating them totally is maybe not the best thing, you know, long-sightedness notwithstanding. But I do think that we should be able to affect our own crops, you know, to keep us alive, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I feel you.
I will just say one more thing. So like the symbiosis for like for pests is interesting to me because just to give a little tidbit, like there's this organism called the pea aphid, and the pea aphid it has a symbiotic relationship with all aphids do. Many organisms that suck out plant juices do have this sort of similar symbiosis with many bacteria. Mm-hmm. If those bacteria go away, they die. So like in the same way that we require a microbiome to function very to have a healthy interaction with the food that we eat and everything working correctly, they need that too. In fact, it's essential to life. And I think it's very fascinating how these relationships start. And sometimes you see where a symbiosis over time can become a parasitism simply through mutations or other sorts of adaptive events.
Wow.
Or like with the chitinase I mentioned earlier, like if a caterpillar eats chitinase because the plant produced it and then it rips up their gut, well, then the organisms that were in their gut will go into that everywhere else in their body and you get a sepsis event.
Good point.
You know,
that's crazy.
So you can use those sorts of techniques to, again, have interesting IPM strategies.
Jeez, that's really cool. All right, before we jump back in with Mr. Gates, let's give a little love to today's sponsor, Mass Medical Strains, everybody. Just go to massmedicalstrains.com today to see their amazing selection. Truly a wide variety of seeds that has something special for every person, every taste, and every mood. Massmedicalstrains.com, everybody. Their selections are based on vibes, the way that you feel when you consume the plant. And they've got everything from psychedelic pure sativas to balanced hybrids to deep sensual medicinal indicas. Their focus is cannabis that makes you feel good, happy, and uplifted with unique flavors, aromas, and sensations. And every order of Mass Medical Strains comes with a pack of high-quality freebie seeds. I've spoken with Mass. I've said this before. He's very passionate about providing high-quality freebies, which I think is really cool. And of course, all seeds are organically produced. Mass is all about that. So go to massmedicalstrains.com and see their selection and see all the seed banks that carry them, like Well Grown Seeds, Neptune Seed Bank, DC Seed Exchange, Great Lakes Genetics, Harvest Mutual Seed Bank, which mygrowpass.com members get a discount on. You'll find Mass all over the place. And finally, follow at Mass Medical Strains 2.0 on Instagram for photos and tips and all sorts of cool stuff. Mass Medical Strains, everybody. Let's go back to the show. I wanted to talk to you about, speaking of ripping things up and shredding things, I wanted to talk to you about diatomaceous earth and what you think of using it in what you recommend or don't recommend you use it for.
So diatomaceous earth, so for those who don't know, it's the crushed up exoskeletons of, I guess they're called something else, but of diatoms, which are organisms that live mostly in the marine areas, in the oceans and such. And diatomaceous earth is good for, like you mentioned, poignantly, they shred up the exoskeletons through like the joints. It gets into the integument. So the little sort of like the less hard chitinous parts of the exoskeleton where the joints bend, kind of like Oof. How you would pierce a knight with like an armor defeating weapon or like a spear perhaps or something like that. So a lot of arthropods, they don't do very good with diatomaceous earth, but it's only great if it's dry. If it becomes wet, then it has no efficacy after that. And perhaps there are ways to like take wet diatomaceous earth and like dry it and recrush it, and maybe that would work, but that would be way too much labor to do in a horticultural sense, at least as I understand it to be. So
right, and I've seen some people like sprinkle it on their pots, for instance, which is nice until, like you mentioned, you water the pot and then it's kind of useless after that.
Exactly, right. And so there are definitely applications for it, and I've seen people utilize it, but to be honest, personally, I don't feel like it's always so great. But in a home growing circumstance, I could see where somebody could like line like an indoor tent, or if they're dealing with ants. Although I would subscribe to a more direct treatment option for things like ants. But DE does have its use, and it's just another tool in the toolbox.
Maybe good for making a little moat, if you will.
There you go.
Talk to me about some other tools, man. Just your favorite IPM strategies that we may not be thinking about.
Sure. Earlier I mentioned the banker plants. So I think the idea of, especially when you're growing at home or you're growing on a small scale, if you have access to other properties or the topography around you, if you have neighbors who you have good relationships with and you know that you have got like an ant problem or you've got a pest problem and you happen to know that like on their property there's like some powdery mildew or there's some aphids or whatever, and if you think or thrips or you're getting the same kinds of things, you know, you could offer to like even help them get rid of their pest problems. I know that a lot of people, you know, your mileage may vary, depends on where you are and what your rapport is, but I think one of the best strategies in IPM is those cultural agents. And what I mean by that are things that are not directly related necessarily to killing the organisms, but to buttressing yourself against them by either making a coalition with other people around you so that you're all on the same page when it comes to taking care of pests, being able to walk your area. So if it's your backyard or your front yard or like wherever you're growing, and just being aware of like the weeds that exist in your area, just that kind of learning and understanding, because a lot of these pests, they can be hosted on many different kinds of plants. And if you cull those plants, if you're able to get rid of those plants in a permanent way so that they cannot, you know, host those pests before they get into your crop, you're going to get rid of so much work before it even starts to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think my number one like advice, which I'm seeing a lot more improvement in, but still, it's crop scouting. So many times I've asked people when they tell me that they have a problem, they have told me that they don't basically look at their plants preventatively, they don't look at them because they think there's too many. Well, take a sample, you know, look at every other plant or every three plant or something like that. Crop scout your plants, crop scout your backyard, crop scout that area so that you know what plants there are, and then research them. Try to learn what those weeds are. Try to learn what the plants that you're growing that aren't cannabis, for example, and what are the pests and the other, and maybe even the beneficial organisms that are attracted to them, like hoverflies and hunter flies and lacewing and all kinds of other things. And depending on where you are in the globe, you may have access to parasitic wasps that don't exist in other places, or other predatory mites that are endemic to your region. Wow. So yeah, just knowing like what is around you, being situationally aware is probably the biggest and best thing, but it's also easier said than done because there are so many details under that umbrella.
I love it, man. Love the loquaciousness, you know, because otherwise you're stuck laconically and that's not good. So it's like you're just an encyclopedia, and I want to dig in further. I want to get your take on the cannabis aphid. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
What do you think? Is it a real thing? What do we do about it? What's going on?
Right. So the cannabis aphid, or the bong aphid, or however we want to call it, it is a problem. The president of the Cannabis Horticultural Association and I have been talking about it at length, because according to him, the bong aphid is a big problem in Northern California, particularly around the Humboldt area and other big cannabis growing areas, because I guess its population is able to explode, apparently. And how much of this is just a lack of preventative sort of prophylactic work on the part of the cultivator, and how much of it is sort of like physiologically related to its ability to reproduce. For those who don't know, most aphids, vast majority of aphids that are pests anyways, they are born pregnant. They have what are called telescoping generations. So aphid females clonally reproduce asexually. And usually this is for their whole life, or it's for at least most of the season until they start producing based on environmental input.
Mm-hmm.
They'll start to produce females that will make eggs, and then they'll overwinter as those eggs. But for the cannabis aphid in particular, you're running into that problem, and it seems like when they have the hosts that they're specialized on, they do extraordinarily well. Other aphids are generalists, and they might have certain pests, certain plants rather, that do better than others for them physiologically. But for the cannabis aphid, no surprise there, the cannabis host is superior, and so is the reproduction.
Whoa. Yikes. And what other attributes does this pest have? Is it, I'd imagine if it's thriving in that area, then it's probably become resistant to a lot of the more popular sprays that those types of growers use.
Unfortunately, we don't have much information on exactly what those parameters are, because there's not a lot of research on that aphid. So that's actually something I'd like to see a lot more of in the academic sphere. And I'm sure that we will as cannabis becomes ever more popular. But some of the things that we should consider when we look at other aphids in this sort of low intel circumstance is, well, 50% of, I think aphids are responsible for at least 50% of the transmission of plant viruses in like agricultural crops. And this is maybe even an understatement. So aphids tend to vector viruses. They tend to vector pathogens.
Wow.
Due to the way that their mouth parts are built, essentially. They tend to have symbioses with bacteria and other sorts of microbes. So it wouldn't be surprising to me at all if the cannabis aphid or other aphids that feed on cannabis, either incidentally or if they adapt to cannabis in the future, which would not be surprising as well, that we might see these sorts of interactions. But without research that kind of confirms or denies this, we're really just in the dark, unfortunately. I wish I could say more about it, but honestly, I don't feel like there is much to say.
Sure. That is good insight in itself.
Yeah.
What do you think about, I know I'm jumping all over the place, but you just sparked a thought in my mind when it comes to the transmission of viruses. What do you think about this hops latent viroid and all the dudding that seems to be taking place for some cannabis growers? Have you seen this?
I have.
What do you think about it?
So hop latent viroid is it's interesting to me. My understanding, and it could be incorrect in some cases, but why don't you let me know if this jives with your understanding of the situation?
Sure.
I believe that a lot of people were receiving rootstock from like Dark Heart Nursery and other companies or something, but for a long time people had been saying that they were having plants that were sort of growing in an odd way or something, and for a long time it was speculation. There wasn't very much to it. And then all of a sudden Dark Heart Nursery comes out and says, hey guys, so it looks like, you know, we were vectoring viruses. Sorry. Also, we also patented the treatment. So if you're interested, give us a call. We'll help you out for money. And that might be a little bit churlish of me to put it that way. But like, That is my understanding, is it kind of went that way. And it just speaks to the importance of hygiene and biosecurity. I mean, I come also from a traditional agricultural background, although it wasn't the most traditional background. But, you know, you have nurseries up in the Netherlands and other parts of the United States and everywhere else, and they go through these really strenuous biosecurity measures to keep pathogens that can be incredibly damaging and systemic and sometimes even cryptic until like later on the plant stage, and then all of a sudden your three-year-old rose plant has rosette disease or something, and you have to just get rid of it all. Or like a phytoplasma that gets into citrus and like that's it, your whole orchard is gone. It's just, there's nothing we can do. Wow. It's incurable.
What are some of these measures that we're lacking?
Mostly just an emphasis, and I would say that a lot of people have kind of been brought up to speed forcefully, but like not bringing in cuts that you don't know, bring in rootstock you're not familiar with, that you don't know the pedigree of.
No quarantining.
Not quarantining is a big one. So even if you're going to do that, at least quarantine it, right? And that kind of a thing. So like, I'm not saying that that people aren't aware of it always, but certainly some industries have just been doing it for longer, specifically for certain plants. And I'm sure that cannabis will come along and be folded in with that.
A lot of dogs in the grow house, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right.
Maybe that's not the case in the tulip gardens of Rotterdam, but I'm not sure.
Not as much, at least.
I want to talk to you about grow tips, grow strategies, and just your consulting work in general. Looks like we got some time left here. So what, in your estimation, are the most common oversights and mistakes that cannabis cultivators are making? We have lots of home growers who listen, but just anything poignant for the professional growers, for the home growers, whatever. And what advice do you give to those growers that you see slipping up?
Absolutely. So I already mentioned earlier, and I want to reemphasize it, crop scouting. If you can do one thing, if you're growing commercially, you should be already doing it, in my opinion. If you are growing for yourself, you're actually at an advantage because you have less plants to scout. And so you have that advantage of being able to really baby your plants and maximize your ability to understand how they're growing and what's affecting them. So crop scouting, both the plants that you're growing and your outside environment, and being aware, taking a little bit of time to like research. Like I live in, I'll just give an example. I live in San Diego, California, right? So I know that that's a port city and it's a border city. And I also know that I live in a chaparral, and that there are some native organisms that are going to be a problem for some plants that I grow, and other ones are going to be more exotic that I know that are going to come across from the horticultural trade in the area. And a second thing that you could do, especially as a home grower, but also as a commercial grower, is get acquainted with your local your local agricultural extension. If there's a university nearby, works with agriculture, and there probably is something, then being aware, accessing their websites, calling them up and just asking, hey, what are some of the pests, what are some of the big crop pests, and just researching them and being aware of them, so that when they appear in your grow space, you immediately identify them and you know their strengths and weaknesses, which is why I make the pest primer series that I do on YouTube. Shameless plug.
No, please. Shameless plug away. YouTube channel is, do you have a specific URL or can people just search and find you?
If they just search Xenthanol, which is admittedly a poor name for SEO reasons, I suppose. it's the word Zen, Zenthanol. It is where I make the pest primer series. And that's a series that's supposed to be like a short primer for various pests, and many of them are on cannabis, but I don't just focus on cannabis pests. Luckily though, for people who are interested, or perhaps luckily for me who makes content anyways, there are many pests that affect cannabis, and most of the pests that affect cannabis are generalists, not specialists like the cannabis aphid we mentioned.
Looks like you have years worth of content. If you're loving this show, you'll love the YouTube page. And yeah, you go into specific detail on each of these specific species of pest. Pretty cool, man. I'm loving it. I do find that there is a lot of interest in this subject. There are some people that really like to dive deep on learning about pests and learning about insects. I look forward to driving some people your way. That's really cool, man.
I'm happy to hear it. I think that, just kind of answer your question in one sentence. One of the most overlooked things people can do is just research the problem organisms before they get into your grow. I mean, that can just save you so much time and hassle and firefighting, both personally and professionally.
I love it, man. Poignant, powerful advice. Let's talk about some of the highly requested topics here. I like to speak with talented growers, and I like to speak with, just really, really educated cultivators and get their highest number one high leverage strategies for the following facets of growing, if you will. First, let's start with increasing yield. What do you recommend growers focus on? What strategies can they employ to increase their yield?
Well, because I mostly work, okay, let me answer it this way. So IPM is integrated pest management. So most people imagine that in the realm of like the direct and somewhat indirect ways of killing and repelling pest organisms, or attracting them elsewhere, or attracting beneficials or whatever. All of those things are prophylactic, and they're or reactive, curative, and they're going to affect your yield because you're not going to have pests anymore, right? So that's pretty, it's pretty standard. But IPM also includes the more indirect things that you can do. So like inoculating your phyllosphere, so your foliage, and your rhizosphere, so your root area, with beneficial microbes, for example, can help increase yield or increase growth.
What do you like to use for that? Do you like to use just natural inputs, or like do you like a product like Mammoth Pea? Mammoth Pea or something like that.
So me personally, I always try to just consider the context. It's hard. I mean, it's my favorite reply to every question, but it's true. It's like that sure. Is the thing. Isn't it? It's sometimes something's more useful yet less useful. And a lot of times, what dictates that are things that like, what are your resources? Where do you live?
That's true.
And what's your labor force like? Is it just you, or is it, you know, 50 other people? But
I don't know if you had any specific products that you like stand behind that you like. For instance, we work with fish shit is a really cool microbial product that they use all like you know, fish waste and all the stuff to make theirs. But I don't know if there's anything you like out there on the market.
Well, I'll say this. There's a Buveria bassiana, so that entomopathogenic fungus I mentioned. It is also an endophyte. So not only is it an organism that feeds on many different arthropods, including sometimes mites and other sorts of things that are usually considered non-target organisms, but if they're weakened or if you get a lot of spores on contact or something, then they can still affect the populations negatively. But Buveria bassiana has been shown in trials, at least in many other plants, not necessarily in cannabis, to actually systemically colonize the leaves, the roots, and even of their hosts. And I bring it up because it seems like, not just because of like pest repellent and pest attacking properties, but also it seems like the Buveria bassiana colonization in some cases actually elicits sort of a standalone like vigor that's not related to like having less pests.
Oh wow! So they also just like it in general.
It just seems to be the case. Some sort of a reaction here is beneficial both for the plant host and for the microbe, which is why I made that sort of mercenary comment. They're allowing other microbes into their bodies to do the job that white blood cells and other things do for us, which That's is so kind cool. of amazing. Yeah,
it's super fascinating, man. And you know, it's really funny if you take a look at any of the major questions that cannabis growers ask, getting an infestation and not doing proper pest management will destroy you in all of the major categories, whether it's the quality of your buds, the, you know, the potency of your buds, the aroma, the flavor of your buds, your yield, your plant's health, like all that stuff just goes to crap when you let the pests get out of control. So I can see why that could easily be the answer to all of the questions. But let's wrap it up with one more. What other advice do you have for overall plant health and vigor? Maybe a product recommendation, or if you're into plant training or compost teas. I'm just trying to set you up here.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah, I think that for overall like plant health and vigor, I think that's it's very important if you're growing like in a soil substrate. I think that it's not controversial or a particularly novel thing that I'm going to say, but just keeping your plants healthy. Like I'll lay on you one of my biggest like contemptuous points that people like to make. They like to say, if you keep your plant healthy enough, and they never define what that means in my experience anyways, then no pest, no pathogen, nothing bad can happen to it. And I'm going to have to say that that's not necessarily true. That's not how the environment works. It is not natural.
It's not how humans work, I'll tell you that.
It's certainly not how humans work, right? But, you know, when I bring that criticism up, then people say, oh, so you're saying the health doesn't matter. No, keeping your plants healthy, keeping your plants, their macro and micronutrients on point, making sure that they're able to actually, making sure that nutrients are bioavailable, and also making sure that nutrients are bioavailable for the you're using, for example.
Oh, you just cut out for a second. Making sure they're bioavailable for what?
For the microbes that you may or may not have in your substrate, and not just on your roots, but also on your foliage. There are many organisms that are on your phylosphere that you can't see because they're microbes. Jeez. But they also affect the pests and other organisms that will come onto them. And they also, you know, they also produce, I have a video on my YouTube channel that talks about microbes in the soil anyways, and about how like the like root exudate that plants exude, you know, like if you make sure that your plant is healthy, it will also exude nutrients for the microbes, which cause things like signals to go off, and it might attract free living microbes, and Whoa. it'll sustain them. It'll stimulate them to act differently depending on the health of the plant. Even it's also an important aspect. Sometimes even plants that are less than optimally healthy in certain regards can actually stimulate like mycorrhizal interactions. A lot of people don't know this, but sometimes a plant has to be stressed in certain ways for microbes to colonize them, and for the plant microbe interaction to actually function. There's also a genetic relationship as well, and so it's not as easy as just spreading a mycorrhizal organism and sending a Hail Mary. Like sometimes that's important, and sometimes
what
like
kind of factors are you talking about there before you move on there?
Sure. So think about it like this. So some people have surmised that people smarter than me, botanists that is, that understand the evolution of plants, vascular plants, as they've gone, as they come from like algal relations millions and millions of years to now. The plants were able to colonize land, some say, specifically because of relationships with other microbes, fungi, and bacteria and other sorts of organisms, and that the pathogen plant relationship has basically it is influenced on a fundamental level how plants have evolved since before Wow. they were even on land. So is it really any surprise that a plant maybe has to be stressed, or that certain other factors that you wouldn't necessarily see in a cultivation space if you're taking care of your plants to actually give rise to these interactions that have evolutionarily sort of developed over millions Whoa. Of years, hundreds of millions of years. And it's sort of counterintuitive, you would think, but maybe not, because a plant that's doing poorly might send out signals that we don't understand as well, or there might be certain sort of genetic reciprocalities that are different. Some people are aware of like what are called nodulation factors. So like for plants that have a relationship with like rhizobia, so like bacteria that fix nitrogen, you know? So there's a sort of like three-way handshake where like the plant has the plant sends out signals, and then the bacteria send out signals, and then they colonize the roots, and then the bacteria actually modifies the plant's genes. I know that sounds very
jeez.
Scary to some people, but that is basically what's happening.
Wow.
There's this sort of genetic level interaction. People have to stress out plants sometimes to facilitate that. But it's also possible we can help find isolates, or we can develop them or breed them to be more receptive with plants without needing those stressors, you know? So like, I don't want to say both that the key and not the key to helping your plants is to stress them and to not stress them. But in some circumstances, again, a lot of this is research that isn't specific to cannabis. So I'm really really looking forward to that information specific for cannabis, because we don't really know.
It's really cool, man. Let's end on this thought, and then we can give out all of your lovely projects to my listeners. I want to ask you if, because you keep talking about this whole idea of thinking of cultivation holistically, do you think we've done ourselves a little bit of a disservice focusing on the magic bullet approach sort of thing, you know, for NPK, you know, 1, 2, 3, and trying to really isolate things, which has gotten us so far, right? Has led to that sort of mode of operation, has produced so many fruitful results, and so much research and knowledge has come from that. But do you think that we need to take a step backwards and go, or maybe a lateral move, and go, no, we need to think about this in a more holistic sense. Like you said, go back to where this all began and really think about it from that approach.
Absolutely, the latter. It's like, it's the bread and butter of everything that I've been saying, and it's also the bread and butter of the account that I've made on YouTube and the science communication that I make. I find that more and more, like I was saying very much in the beginning, as we understand these ecological relationships, the what's called the hollow biome, you know, the genomes of all the organisms, abiotic and biotic factors, and all of these interactions in space and time, you know, to bring in some physics there, right? Like all of these factors contribute and have existed way before human speciation has happened, way before agriculture. And so considering that information, as we understand things like how did plants evolve, and like what was the relationship between fungi and plants, and like that sort of stuff alone can give us, like you were saying, kind of a magic bullet understanding from which we can produce strategies and tactics to affect the plants beneficially, and we can sort of manipulate our understanding around the plants so that they can grow happier and healthier, and we can also grow better and not necessarily poison ourselves or right. Go overboard on certain things. Because I think that, and I also want to say that there's something to be said of like human responsibility and the sort of incongruity of like somebody can be very well-meaning with an understanding or a product or something, and somebody can just as easily or do something irresponsible with it. And, you know, whose fault is it really? Is it the person who produced the thing, or is it the person who utilized it incorrectly? Is that true for all cases and all situations? No, not necessarily. But like one of the problems with biocontrols in the beginning was that people were very skeptical. And then they were like, oh, well, we tried them a little bit, but it didn't seem to work. And it's like, now we know that, like, if you lectin in your crop, then, you know, it's going to be poisonous to your biocontrols for like a long period of time. And like all of these little nuances allow us to actually come to the conclusion, actually come to the result that we want. Without those many, many, many details, then we're stuck scratching our heads and not knowing what's going to happen.
It's really cool, man. I feel like we're just scratching the surface, so I'd love to have you back on anytime. Anytime you're dropping anything new or want to swing by, please, we'd love to have you. Thank you for doing this.
Oh, I really appreciate it, and I will be happy to come back again.
Zenthanol on YouTube, Zenthanol. Check out all the videos. And why don't you give out your Instagram along with anything else that you're working on?
Absolutely. So my Instagram is @SyncAngel, SyncAngel. Just wanted to reiterate, I am an IPM specialist. I do site evaluations professionally for people who want to look at their IPM strategy. I go to the site locally and I assess the situation with the cultivators, and it always comes across with new information, and it always benefits the cultivator. I am also working on a chapter for a book that will be actually, I've been communicating with a dean of agriculture in India, and I'm coming out with a chapter on cannabis pests and pathogens in in the United States on cannabis in particular. And I also have a treatise on my Patreon. And what that is a living document where I have, through my personal experiences and the experiences of other people, I have collated all of the pests and pathogens that I can find academic evidence or observational evidence of.
Whoa.
Pests in cannabis. And some of those organisms are from like South Africa, for example. Some of those organisms are from the California coastline, so I have a treatise that's available on Patreon for those who are interested. And I have other projects, but I can't always talk about everything, so I will be back on in the future to talk about those ones.
That sounds wonderful, my friend. Thank you so much. Everybody, give him a follow. Check out everything he's got going on. Thank you all so much for listening. Follow GrowCast on Instagram at GrowCast. And if you want to talk to me directly, at JordanRiverIG on Instagram. One more time, thank you so much, Matthew. It really was a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Everybody listening, thank you. We'll see you next time on the GrowCast podcast. Be safe and grow smarter.